Hello, it is December 29th, 2014. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 456 of the Will Leach Experience Podcast on Sports on Earth. I am Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I apologize for the lack of podcasts. Happy holidays. I'm Will. You may recognize me from podcasts like the one 3 weeks ago and the one like 3 weeks before that. I do apologize for that. As you know, the holiday season is quite hectic. We were supposed to have Jeb Lund on, and then he had to cancel once, then I had to cancel once, and so we'll just get him after the new year. But it is tradition around these parts, and by tradition, I mean we did it last year, so I'm going to try to do it again, to have our guest today talk us through the end of the year, of all that's happened this year, and so on. And talk about stuff going on with him, Tommy Craggs. He actually just left Deadspin. He ran it for 3.5 years, the longest tenured editor of Deadspin. I think that's right. I think that sounds right. And he's now the executive editor of Gawker Media, which means he's the boss of everybody there. So if you didn't like Craggs before, you're really not going to like him now because he runs more sites. But if you're smart, you like Craggs and know that he is about as talented a person in the world of journalism as you will find, and he also happens to be a good friend of mine. So we like to talk about all sorts of fun things. So we're going to do that, but for the record, we're going to be back to normal. By normal, I mean probably weekly shows. We should be back to normal after the new year. We'll have a post-wildcard preview show with Lindsey Jones, the NFL writer, for USA Today, and my travel buddy to Sochi back in February, which seems like it was about 15 or 20 years ago. Remember that? Everyone just was convinced we were all going to die when we went out there. And here we are, still standing strong. Anyway, so thank you for hanging in with me. I apologize for the delay. We will be back to normal after the new year. Hope you're having a wonderful holiday season. You should have plenty of time. The week between Christmas and New Year's is my personal favorite week out of the year because everyone is supposed to be working but not really working and kind of down. It's like the closest I get to anyone gets to having a sort of working vacation. So anyway, here is Craggs, and happy holidays. All right, first off, Mr. Craggs, thank you for continuing our tradition. By tradition, of course, I mean we did this last year, so I'm going to try to do it again, of coming in and making a rare public appearance to chat with me. First off, congratulations on the new gig. I saw you the night that this all went down. We were supposed to go to the Illini game, and you canceled on me. I got to go with Tim Burke, so that was actually an upgrade. But but I saw you that night and got to congratulate you then. Allow me to congratulate you in person now. How do you feel? Are you overwhelmed? Are you excited?
I'm excited. I'm very excited. I haven't officially started. I haven't signed any paperwork yet, actually, which is a little odd. But I guess as of next week, it will be official. And you know, what if I were a more charismatic leader and charismatic public speaker, I would be conveying this excitement to the staff because this is a rare moment when the publisher's wishes and the publisher's hopes align perfectly with editorial's hopes and wishes, and mine especially. And I think you probably find that, I think you're lucky to find that even once in your journalism career. Having worked for a number of different kinds of publishers, there's always friction there. And we have a window now where Nick Denton has decided he wants to do exactly what we got in this business to do. He wants stories. He wants good stories. And traffic is kind of a secondary concern. And I've spent the past couple of weeks trying to convey that to the staff, that this is and it's sort of a problem when you have a staff of mostly 20-somethings who are on either their first or second jobs in journalism and don't know the misery of working at an alt weekly where you're urged to use both sides of a notebook because you just don't want to buy notebooks, right, or you're told not to use LexisNexis too much because your searches are too broad. Like,
right.
You know, so I feel like that, you know, I say this stuff and they just kind of look at me slack-jawed, but I really do think this is an opportunity that isn't going to happen again for a lot of people. And, you know, I think this window will probably shut in a year. You know, Nick's head and heart are in the right place right now, but
but maybe not in perpetuity.
Right. In a year, he might decide that the sites and the company needs to be something a little bit different, and I will, you know, be shuffled off into some other job somewhere. But right now, we have this amazing window where everything is lining up. The planets are aligning perfectly, and I'm very excited about that.
I mean, I would argue that the selection of you at that point would be a sign. Like, it's hard to imagine. Like, Tommy, you're a very organized guy, and you're a very smart guy, and you're a wonderful writer in many ways. But this is specifically what you do best. It's hard to imagine a lot of other people. Like, it feels like, yeah, the planets are aligning, but another part of the planets aligning is you being the person to run it. In a lot of ways, is this a look at Deadspin's success and say we need to make this larger across the board? Are you gonna, or is this even a shift in gears even for you a little bit?
I mean, I guess in a really general sense, he wants me to kind of continue the ideas that underpinned a lot of what we've been doing at Deadspin since you were running the joint. And it's the idea of bringing in stories, you know, the unauthorized version of the story, or just a really great piece of writing, like, you know, Pat Jordan on Jose Canseco, just something like that. Like, this is just a continuation of that basic idea. You know, AJ brought me in to do that sort of thing. And I think my job here is basically to do on a bigger scale what AJ wanted me to do on a smaller scale at Deadspin when I started, you know, bringing in these kinds of stories. So yeah, I mean, it is a nice thought to think that this represents the Deadspinification of Gawker Media. Right. And I think we can indulge in that fantasy for a little bit. I think we've earned that, right?
Yeah, and we'll indulge it briefly until we really have to run away from it, apologizing and screaming. Well, like, no, nope, not at all. That's an entirely different thing. What are you talking about? We'll enjoy the brief moment until we have to run away. Because that was always a strange thing. You know, when I was doing it, I certainly liked Nick, and I certainly liked what they were doing at Gawker, but I really felt it was actually important, just because it was such a different kind of reader initially coming to the site, to keep it as separate from Gawker as possible. And I think Nick agreed in a lot of ways. I felt like, because I think you finally was like, wow, we have a site that heterosexual dudes read. I had no idea I was capable of such a thing. And so I think it was something that I really tried to keep separate. But now it's funny, you know, I wrote my yearly fill in for Drew thing the other day. And it's amazing to me that, you know, the idea, I wrote it for Deadspin. And among the criticisms of it is, because it talks about, you know, echo chamber culture and so on. And one of the criticisms is, wow, some guy writes for Gawker Media and tells us this, they're the biggest echo chamber at all. Like, whether you agree with that or whether you don't agree with that, it's still strange for me to think that, and this is just because from my time of it, that now Gawker Media is this unified thing that is collectively seen as one in a way, even though these sites are all dramatically different.
Yeah. Well, I remember when AJ took over Gawker, and we had a little bit of a roast. What, his third roast?
Yeah.
That he's had. I think we referred sneeringly to Gawker as a gay interest site for heterosexual women.
Yes.
Which is still, you know, true in a lot of ways, but, like, you know, that was very much that was closer to the old kind of Gawker than it is now. Like, it's a much bigger site. It's big enough to be, you know, like you said, it's thought of as like there's some sort of monolithic Gawker Media that is part of this echo chamber, this liberal media echo chamber or whatever, rather than like individual voices at these relatively small sites writing whatever interests them.
It obviously had to change. I mean, that was the joke I always made, that like Gawker could no longer be run by cute girls from Brooklyn. Like not to say the cute girls from Brooklyn, you know what I mean? Like it couldn't be like in the early days of Gawker, that was that idea that it was this personal. Everyone's trying to be like Spires, and now like now it's an organization in a lot of ways. And if it hadn't have made that change, I always talk about this with Mark Lasanti. If these sites hadn't have made these change away from that personal idea, they all would have died. Do you agree?
Oh yeah. I mean, it is the goals are much different now. And you know, I think I don't know. I mean, the fact that John Cook is coming back,
Yes,
you know, John Cook,
of
former
course.
Gawker editor and one of the best reporters out there, the fact that he's coming back to run investigations for the whole company sort of speaks to the way the ambitions have changed, not only for Gawker itself, but for the whole company. I mean, the idea that there will be an investigations editor sort of above all eight sites and sort of working with all eight sites is really interesting, and I think marks some sort of a, you know, evolutionary shift for the company.
How much when you're going to when you talked earlier about the idea of like a lot of these 20 somethings on their first or second job, you know, because I think that sometimes too, I want to sometimes go to some of the people that work at Gawker. I'm like, you realize you have the best job in the world way too early for you to, like not to say they don't deserve the job or they have not earned the job, but there is this kind of idea like, man, you have no idea how shitty jobs are sometimes, man. And is it hard? I mean, you're still in the first days of it, but is it hard to make that shift in the idea that like the way you've been doing, not that you've been doing poorly, but your job is going to change a little bit. And I know everybody knows you and everybody likes Tommy. It just seems like there's going to be a lot of hard conversations that you're going to have in the next couple of months if you haven't had them already to because people's jobs are going to be changing, right?
I mean, I think mostly for the better. I think, you know, the big thing, and this came up in the Gawker Media All Hands meeting. This has come up in several meetings. This came up in my interview with Nick and some of the others for this job. You know, we're talking about not pandering to the Facebook algorithm anymore, not doing the stories. Not just doing the stories that we know will throw another ping pong ball into the lottery machine and maybe go viral or whatever. Doing the stories that only are interesting to us and make us feel good about our jobs, that sort of thing. Doing the stories that tell some sort of important truth about the world, about the internet, whatever. And it can be a funny truth, it can be whatever, but just not doing the horse shit stories that we've all done them, and I
Right.
know that when I edited Deadspin that we would have occasionally do them, and I would hope that the writers didn't feel too put upon to do them, but just the stories that we knew would blow up because of, you know, more or less for no other reason because of Facebook's algorithm. And the hope is to just kind of cut that part of the sites out entirely and take the traffic hit maybe. And invest that time elsewhere, and invest that time and energy elsewhere. And I think, by and large, writers want to do that. I think they would rather work on projects or on something where they actually have something to say, and they aren't just copy and pasting from Reddit or whatever.
Is
And so I think that's actually a really easy conversation to have.
right.
You know, that bullshit you had to dump on the page to because you knew it would do X number of uniques. Like, let's just not do that anymore. And if we take a little bit of a traffic hit, okay.
It is
Instead
okay.
of doing
That
that,
is okay. Like, is it short term okay? You've got a mandate that that's okay.
yes. I mean,
Okay.
this was something Nick actually said in my interview. He actually used the words flat traffic, and he was painting a hypothetical. There was, you know, he said, let's say we gave you this kind of budget, and just said all you had to do was keep traffic flat over the next year. Could you make us proud of the sites? And like my first response was just to laugh. Like if the order is to keep traffic flat, like and do cool stories, like no problem, man. I will have the best job in media if that's all I need to do. Because there is, and we've seen this at Deadspin, there is an intersection between cool stories and traffic-friendly stories. Like, those things line up a lot more often than I think a lot of people realize. Some of my favorite stories have been some of our biggest traffic draws. And obviously, on the top level, you have a lot of just absolute horseshit that you're kind of ashamed of. But in any given month, some of our biggest stories will be also some of the stories that I think the writers are proudest of, I'm proudest of, that went through a real editing process, that went through, that were reported out, that sort of thing.
A large part of this, too, though, is, I'm coaching them up a little bit. Like, I look at some of the great stories, like, just to look at the, some of the stuff, the difference between, like, Tom Lee or Greg Howard or some of those people from when they started at Deadspin at now is very clear that Tommy Craigs has been working with them every day for 2 years. And not say they were terrible before, but saying that, like, it's clear there's been a maturation and also a confidence in them that maybe wasn't there a couple of years ago. Are there enough Tommy Craigs at each site around Gawker Media to make that happen?
I don't think it was me. I think it was as much just sort of a product of the environment at Deadspin that had been there when I took over. And it allows a writer a lot of freedom, but not so much that it's just sort of paralyzing. And you are free to fuck up a little, and you are free to try things out and sort of find your voice and to write about the things that interest you, even if the traffic doesn't come along with your interests, and I think anybody coming into that kind of environment as a writer is going to improve regardless of who is actually doing the line edits.
Obviously you haven't had much to do with it considering you just got promoted to run the whole damn company. So obviously, yes. So you're right. I totally gave you too much credit. Have you guys announced a new editor yet? You haven't. Can you say? If you can't say, I'm not going to push you to say it.
I haven't. It's, I don't think it's, well, I guess I'll just say it's going to be Tim Marchman.
okay.
the hope, and Marchman and I sort of talked about it, was to use the opening as sort of a recruiting tool, just to see who was loose and available out there.
Right. Have you already done
but
that?
But at this point, we haven't really. we've had enough.
Don't
other
worry.
Stuff to
nobody
deal with.
Listens to this. Don't worry. Nobody listens. Your news is still safe.
But for anyone actually listening to this who is loose and available, you should look me up anyway. there are many jobs to be had here at this point.
At Deadspin or at Gawker Media in general, or at both?
Yes, at both. Both.
Okay. So now you are the. You officially start, but your tenureship as editor of Deadspin will end next month. Now this year, when?
It will end, I guess, January 1st.
January 1st. Okay, so you made it. So to go through the three, soon to be four, with Mystery Man or Woman taking over next month, because I'm still trying to, maybe your pal Seth Davis. Seth Davis would be great. He could run the political coverage. I was there from September 2005 to June 2008. Delora there was from June 2008 to June 2011. You are the longest serving member at Deadspin, June 2011 to January 2015. I always have joked with you that I want you to run the site for 15 years. You obviously ignored my entreaties to you. Though you can come back, right? If you do this a year and you're like, okay, I did this, would you come back and do Deadspin? Do you want to get back into sports? I'm always curious of, like, your specific demands. Is it just stories? Do you want to do more? Would you like to get back to sports someday, or we'll just see how it goes?
I don't know. I mean, there is a lot of unfinished business at Deadspin. There are stories that Tim Marchman and I were working on that I want to bring home. Whether it's in this capacity as executive editor of Gawker Media, whether it's down the road. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not, this isn't like a graduation from sports.
It's not a comedian making a serious movie.
Yeah, no, not at all. This is a comedian doing a comedy on a much bigger budget.
Okay, fair enough. So, well, yeah. That always works out well when that happens.
Yeah, right.
but I'm curious, you know, how did the job evolve? Has it been the same? Do you feel like sports, what you were writing about, whether it's sports media or just the sports culture, do you think you got better or worse in those 3.5 years? Do you feel like kind of when you stop back for what you kind of learned at the beginning of Deadspin till now, did you like it more by the end? Did it exhaust you? I'm just curious about what you learned about Deadspin and kind of sports culture while doing the job.
I would say that when I first started, and when I first started writing for Deadspin, which is in May 2009, that there was, you know, Fire Joe Morgan was still around, and the idea of these like very clueless, kind of siloed off daily newspaper sports writers, like these people were still, I wouldn't say running the show, but they were still really prominent.
There were a lot of them.
And they were, you know, unaccountable. And so the best you could do was take funny and smart pot shots from the peanut gallery. And now it's very different. And I think this is sort of a guiding thesis for Brian Curtis at Grantland. And he's written about this a number of times, and we've talked about this a number of times, but there are certain issues where you just don't see the sort of hackery you used to, whether it's because it's out of fear that, you know, that what's no longer the peanut gallery, what's actually, you know, a fairly influential block of readers/writers will just like drop the shit hammer on your piece of prose or whatever, this dumb thought you had.
Right. The leaving the yard, if you will. The leaving the yard.
Leaving the yard, yeah. Right. Or whether it's, you know, because the sort of people who take in those jobs now are smarter and better informed than they used to be. For whatever reason, I think you have seen the window shifting on a lot of things that people 4 or 5 years ago would have been just hopelessly stupid about. And there's just what's settled doctrine now is kind of shocking in a lot of ways. The sabermetrics arguments, they're still sabermetrics arguments, but, it's being fought on the margins of the issue.
Right.
You know, by and large, it's just settled doctrine sabermetricians have something to offer the conversation and often know more about the game than the columnists who are in the press box, whatever. And I think you see it on a lot of politically tinged issues. I think you saw it during the various lockouts, where, you know, it is shocking to read old stories about labor issues, even as recently as the 90s and the 80s, that are kind of shockingly anti-player. And buy into, you know, the idea that these players are greed heads and thugs who, you know, these no account greed heads and thugs who are just out to make a little more money, and don't care about Joe Sixpack and the Sams or whatever. Yes. Like
And the hardworking owners.
Yeah, and the coverage of the labor issues over the last few years, and there have been many of them, is so much more sophisticated now and so much smarter. And it's, I feel like a lot of that has to do with, you know, with the peanut gallery, and with people who actually know about these issues and actually care about these issues, writing compellingly about them on the internet and sort of moving the window for, the more mainstream writers, and not just moving the window, but also giving sort of intellectual cover. If the people on the internet are sort of shifting the consensus a little bit that gives, you know, the columnist at the Indianapolis Star a little more room to, you know, to venture an opinion that might not sit well with his, it might not have sat well with his readers a few years ago, but now is a little bit more acceptable, you know? And so I think that's like a big service that a lot of the, like a lot of internet sports writers have provided, is providing that intellectual cover for the mainstream sports writers who 10 years ago wouldn't have felt so free to venture an opinion that is a little bit at odds with, you know, the establishment opinion or whatever.
Well, see, I find that encouraging. First off, the columnist of the Indianapolis Star is Greg Doyle now, actually. So now we've gone like backwards in a lot of ways. But you know, I find it generally encouraging. That's great news. Like, I find it encouraging, and it makes me feel good about the way things are going. I don't always feel that way when I get on the internet, Tommy, I will confess. It's encouraging that in a macro sense, because I think you're right, and to hear you put it that way makes me feel a little better, because in a macro sense, you know, it's like the same way that when people remind you that there's actually less war and less murder than almost any other time in recorded history right now. It just doesn't seem that way. and I think that's encouraging in macro sense that things are actually going that way. And I think that, frankly, you know, I think that you and Deadspin have had a large part in making that happen. I'm curious when you bring up the political aspect, because I have to say, I've mentioned this before. I wrote about this in the New York Magazine column about the notion that, you know, it used to be, you know, I mean, I've been away from Deadspin for 6 years, 6.5 years, which is kind of amazing. It's going to be 10 next year, by the way, Tommy. We got to get me, you, Delorio, and Marchman together for another funny boxing photo shoot. I think that'll be really fun. When I wrote about this, when people, you know, used to be about Deadspin, it used to be Delorio's making it too trashy, or it was Tommy's making it too smart, or whatever. Now, literally, the only thing that people talk to me about Deadspin is that how it's gotten political. It is the number one, without question, not even close, thing that people say about Deadspin. They don't say it's trash. Very rarely do you hear people say that it's trashy anymore. But so now it's part of the liberal media. Now, that's now I can't tell if – I just can't tell, because I have a rule about not being on Twitter too often. I'm like, hey, look, there's like my kid. I'll go look at my child and remind myself that, well, he's going to end up being a jerk on the internet someday too. So for a moment, he won't be. But certainly when you look – you know, when I look at that, I can't tell if it's because I'm separated from it. So I can't tell – if it's because everyone just does that about everything now, or if there's an element of truth to it. I'm curious, what do you think about, because you obviously hear the criticism all the time too.
What is that? I'm sorry.
You obviously hear the criticism all the time too. What do you think of the criticism?
Well, I think they're one of the, I guess, my central thesis as a writer and then as an editor was that this whole idea that sports are some exempt realm, that they exist outside of politics, it's an escape, all that sort of shit, is absolutely a myth, and a pernicious myth, that sports are very much a politicized space, and that politics inform a lot of what happens in sports, and it's only through a will, like this sort of willful blindness that, for a long time people have insisted that, you know, sports are the escape. Right. You know, Mitch Albom just wrote a year in review column. That was like, you know, that was essentially the thrust of his awful, awful column. Right. Was that
as much thrust as there was?
Yeah. And I take issue with that. And I think that's like, it's actually, that idea has allowed a lot of harm to be visited upon fans and upon, you know, local municipalities that end up paying out the nose for new stadiums, you know, on our national drug policy. You know, these things, there is the membrane there that we like to pretend is very thick, doesn't actually exist. Sports are like anything else in American life. They are, they are highly politicized. They are the product of, our political culture. So I, and you know, I don't think there's been, you know, there hasn't been any kind of specific change in Deadspin's mission since I took over. But it just so happens that a lot of the issues that have come up since I've been editor also happen to be highly, you know, politically charged issues, whether it's labor stuff, whether it's, you know, Ferguson spilling over into the sports pages, or just Ferguson itself, which, you know, which Greg Howard wrote one of the best things that anybody wrote about Ferguson. And that was, you know, I want, if any of the writers on Deadspin feel strongly about something, I wanted them to write it. Whether or not it was a perfect fit on the site, that was their assignment. If they felt strongly about something, they had to write it. Their audience was me, basically. Right. And, you know, I,
okay. The major criticism I get then, perhaps I phrased it incorrectly. It's not so much just that the site's gotten too political, but literally that it's gotten too liberal. Like, it's part of that sort of thing. Now, my question is, do you think that, and for what it's worth, it's very rare that I ever hear someone that's a liberal say, get this out of my sports. Like, get the politics out of my sports. That's generally a conservative viewpoint. Do you think that's happenstance? Do you think that's willful blind? Like, I'm just like, well, I will say that, like, you know, I tend to be, regardless of my own politics or your own politics, you know, certainly as you can tell from my piece over the weekend, I tend to try to be as centrist as possible on everything, even if it's not necessarily my personal belief. I try. I fail a lot, but I try. Everybody should try. And thank you for that. But more to the point, like, it's hard to deny that the people who say keep politics out of sports almost overwhelmingly tend to be conservative. But is that because there's not a great conservative sports blog, or is that just because they're like that, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, these are people sort of fighting for the status quo. And the status quo, especially in sports, has been very right of center, and it's a very right of center kind of cultural space or whatever.
Do you think individual sports are different? I feel like the NFL is more right wing than, say, than the NBA, and baseball is not as far as the NBA, NFL, but around there.
Yeah, I mean, I think David Stern has sort of, I've written about this probably too often, but David Stern, you know, David Stern felt compelled to pander to the right of center people in his fan base, or who might be in his fan base. You know, David Stern was the guy who brought the dress code to the NBA, and it's now being celebrated as this kind of creative explosion in the sartorial choices of NBA players. But, you know, that's it's still in the dress code at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's not why he did it. Right.
And so, the idea that the NBA is you know, the fucking French commune or whatever next to the NFL is sort of ridiculous.
And I think we'll see that particularly with Michelle Roberts, it seems like she. I feel like her fundamental thing is to kind of expose a lot of these status quo things that we've all just accepted in sports, like free agents, like drafts and so on. And I feel like it's funny that the league, that whatever your thoughts, I agree that the NBA is not, you know, it's not the nation, but certainly I would love to see Michelle Roberts be the head of the NFL Players Union, put it that way.
Yeah. No, and she's been great. And the funny thing is she's been saying, you know, she hasn't been saying anything terribly radical, but it has been received.
Yeah, it feels radical because it's sports. Right.
Yeah, and people don't really talk like this. And it was the same response when D. Smith took over the NFLPA. He wasn't saying anything terribly radical. And he hasn't been a radical union leader by any measure. But just challenging these shibboleths that have just been accepted in sports leagues. Yeah, even the idea of a draft is so embedded in the year-to-year sports experience that, like, you know, this is just a facet of the sports calendar that you accept. And just challenging that, it's being taken as this like radical bomb throwing. I'm thrilled that they're saying it. It's kind of depressing that it's so notable that they're saying these like rather obvious things that a lot of people have been saying in one form or another. But this is all part of the window moving a little bit. That the new head of the NBA Players Union doesn't feel like she has to concede on certain issues is part of that shifting window. And it is a little more, the environment is a little more friendly where you can question some of these fundamental ideas that underlie any sports league and not be laughed out of the room or whatever. Like that is a change. And I think that's a change that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years too.
I'm going to go back to Deadspin a little bit before I start peppering you with trivia questions and let you go for the rest of the day. One of my favorite memories of actually being involved with Deadspin was actually after I left. It was when DeLorio was running it, and it was the madness of, is Tommy going to go to Grantland or is Tommy not going to go to Grantland? And I was obviously AJ and I are you and I are good friends, but AJ and I are also good friends. And I was a little bit more abreast of what was going on in the day-to-day of Deadspin at that time, certainly than I am now. Now I just can't believe you guys let me keep running movie reviews. And when I remember when all that was going down, and you would accept it. You had not officially. Did you ever officially accept the job?
I never signed anything, but right. I said yes.
You said yes. And okay. It was, and I remember. Yeah. So and like we were planning your going away party. I think you were about.
I had a going away
party. Right. And I remember even at that party, Deloria was like, "He's not going." the whole time, I was like. Delorio, like, you need to prepare for life after Craig's. He has accepted the job. We are at his going away party. He's going. He's like, he is not going over there. There's just no goddamn way that he's going over there. And bless his heart, he was totally freaking right. I'm curious, how is your life different and how is Deadspin different if you do, in fact, accept that job?
I said this before, I'm fairly certain I would have been fired after 6 months at Grantland anyway. I don't, there's no doubt in my mind.
I have to say it doesn't see other than the ongoing dumbass Simmons ESPN, kerfuffle or whatever it is. When I read Grantland, I certainly don't get the sense that those guys are being muffled.
No, it's not that. I would have been a petulant little shit. And
okay, I see that.
You know, and this was still very early on in Grantland, and Grantland was still finding its voice. It would have been a disaster. And for both of us. And I think, you know, I probably would have wound up back at Deadspin anyway. I think things would have played out more or less the same way. I don't know. I look at some of the things that people are doing on Grantland, and I sort of see like, okay, maybe I could have done something like that. Maybe I could have like done something like this idea that Brian Curtis did, or maybe something like this Brian Phillips story, or, you know, when I give over to fantasy the counterfactual, I still don't think I would have been able to work there. What brought the whole thing down was this kind of insane internal politics that I don't like, that I'm allergic to. And, what I found out later was that a lot of the reason my job fell apart The job offer fell apart. Was, you know, I'd written something about Lynn Hoppus, who is maybe the dumbest person ever to have had a byline on ESPN.
Do we know where he is now? Have we heard?
I think he's doing something in Florida, some sort of PR thing, which is, you know, that's
probably right.
Yeah, that's right. But I do think he was the dumbest person ever to have a byline on ESPN, and that I'm including Darren Revelle in that. So I had written something sort of mean about him, and I wrote that after I had said yes to the Grantland job, and I, honest to God, started writing that without even thinking that it might cause a problem. It just didn't occur to me. It was such a bread and butter part of my job at Deadspin that I opened that file and started typing, and thinking like, yeah, this is just me poking fun at the dumbass at ESPN. And then after I saved it, I realized, okay, this might cause some problems, but fuck it. Like, I'm still working at Deadspin. I have to do my job at Deadspin. This is obviously the sort of thing I write about at Deadspin. Like, if ESPN objects to that, that's their problem. And that, what I didn't realize was that there was just this, that story dropped into the middle of this turf war. You know, you had Grantland, which was, you know, launching and getting a lot of attention for the launch. And then you had Page Two, which was,
still around.
going through its death rattle at that point.
Right.
And then you had ESPN the magazine, which, you know, felt that you know, Grantland was horning in on its territory, and, you know, even getting potentially trying to poach its writers. And at that time, I'd also I had talked to ESPN the magazine very, very casually about maybe coming on as a columnist. This was before the Grantland stuff ever came about, and this is partly because I had some old friends there from when I was a fact checker at ESPN the magazine. So when I wrote the thing about Lynn Hoppus, and when Grantland had, you know, I guess hired me tentatively, what I didn't realize was that there was this, you know, turf war going on. ESPN the magazine was pissed because they thought that Grantland had poached me from ESPN the magazine, even though I wasn't going to do it. And Page Two thought that this was like a shot at them, a bank shot at them from Bill Simmons through me, which is insane to think that like Bill Simmons is using me for propaganda purposes.
That is literally the most absurd thing I've ever heard. like eight different directions.
And I think there are people at Grantland who thought that I was like self-sabotaging. I don't really know. But that's what, like, that was a big reason that things fell apart. And I guess there are other reasons too, but I just, like, that's, you know, people thought I was playing ESPN the magazine, not Grantland, and vice versa. And
the whole thing seems like a pretty good sign of why it was a good decision not to go.
Yeah, and but people were projecting their own. It's the kind of place where, you know, for reasons of self-preservation, you have to be kind of a careerist. And you kind of have to look out for yourself. So people were projecting all these careerist narratives onto what I was doing, thinking that I was like trying to get more money. I've never asked for more money in my professional career. I avoid any conversation about money. I was not playing anyone off each other. But the fact that like even Bill Simmons himself thought that I was working some sort of back channel here tells you a lot about that kind of work environment and, you know, what kind of place ESPN is. And I wanted no piece of that. I sat down with John Walsh and he was just a nightmare. And in the middle of that meeting, I was like, I don't want to work for this guy. I don't want to work for this place.
Now it begs the question, you know, are you Gawker for life? Like, even if you leave, like in a year, will you go back to Deadspin? Will you, like, I feel like the amount of freedom that you have and are facilitating to your staff, as you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, is relatively unprecedented. Never mind in all sports media, in pretty much all of media. Are you going to get spoiled? Are these kids going to get spoiled? Or can they go back to compromise corporate media after this? Can you?
I mean, it would have to be a very good situation for me. I don't know. Like, I haven't thought more than a year
Yeah,
ahead.
you haven't started this job
I
yet. Right.
mean, I took this job with every expectation that I would be fired in a year. And like, this isn't self-deprecation or anything.
Right,
Like, this
I
that's
know.
actually a really liberating thought that like, I have a year's window to do cool shit. And I will probably not live up to every expectation because, you know, Nick Denton has very high and occasionally crazy expectations. But I will get to do whatever I want to do. And if it doesn't work out, then I will go on to something else. But it's you know, it's a difference between like a TV show on the BBC and one of the equivalent in America, where it's just this open-ended thing where season after season they're trying to they write themselves into a box and then write themselves out of it, and it's just this like drawn out awful thing. Whereas the BBC, you have these like, you know, 12 episode arcs or whatever, and the show is better for it. And I feel sort of like that's that I'm running a BBC show, I guess.
I like the idea of a metaphor as Gawker Media to the rest of media, like that friend you had in college that went away for a semester to Europe and comes back. It's like, oh no, we don't do it like that in Europe. Over there, the seasons are short. Over there, yes. So I like that idea. That's actually not the worst metaphor for it. All right. Well, the last thing I want to ask you. Well, I have two last things I want to ask you. One is I want to talk about our Illini very briefly. I was at the Bragging Rights game. You and I have an ongoing battle. I think we're generally on the same side now, and proof that I was wrong before and you were correct. But now I'm on your side. Because I was pro Weber and you were anti Weber and you were right and I was wrong and I said it again and I'm
But
not doing.
I was not reflexively anti-Weber. I
Right, right,
knew
right.
what he did for that team.
Right, you're right. 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 There are many reflexively anti-Weber people. I just really felt like I was so sold on Weber as a teacher and a leader because I'm the dope that believes crap like that, that I was like, no, he's just got to get them to work. And then it just made it very clear that that was not going to happen. And you were right about that much earlier than me. And now I'm Team Gross. I'm very excited about Gross. Are you pleased with how this team is going?
I really like this team. I think I want, you know, that one signature win over a good team. I would like to see that, and I think this bunch has it in them. But this is the first time where I think we've really seen a gross team. You know,
It's a
and
bunch
it's
of
not just that they're
shooters.
shooting a
Yeah,
lot of threes, they're making a lot of threes. And you know, they went into a little bit of a slump, but these are actual shooters.
And there's more coming, which is to me that's the exciting thing. He seems to have the opposite viewpoint of Weber. Weber was the idea that you get defensive guys and you can teach them offense. Gross has the exact opposite idea, which when you think about it, makes a lot more logical sense. So.
You know, and in a weird way, I think that like Rhavonte Rice is sort of the odd fit here. I mean, he is incredible, and he gets into the lane as well as anybody, and he finishes well, and he's starting to shoot insanely well now. But he does feel like
He's
he
not
doesn't
the
quite feel like a gross kind of player.
right, 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 right.
And
But you
I
know,
do think sorry, go ahead.
I feel like that's. But of course, he saved them so many times this year that I wonder if that will ultimately only help Gross. Because, like, to me, I had the same thought going into this year. I was like, I want just let Starks and Cosby shoot like crazy, and then Rice can get fouled every once in a while. And now we realize when the shots are falling, you need a guy like Rice, and so you hope that you know you want to that little bit of Weber grit just kind of sneaking in there a little bit.
But I also like I really do think at years end this will be Malcolm Hill's team.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I think we're seeing it already, but you know, if Rice weren't as good as he is, I think this would be Malcolm Hill's show. You know, he is what I think I may have said this to you at one point. I think he is what Jeremy Richmond was supposed to be and what, like, Ryan Blackwell many, many years ago was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And it's kind of exciting to see him blossom.
He's got some ABA game to him, which I really like.
Yeah, he does a little bit of everything. Yeah. He has a really intuitive sense of the game. I'm kind of excited about him.
I'm excited about the whole thing. I got really excited about the teams that had Tom Michael and Deion Thomas and nobody else. So I get excited across the board. And the last thing I want to say is actually not a question. But Tommy, you know, it's rare that I have people. I have people on the podcast who I like personally and I know. But you are one of the people I consider. It's okay. You were at my wedding. We're friends. We can say friends. Go over friends. It's okay.
Yes, I wouldn't have gone if we weren't friends.
No, okay. Well, thank you. I'm honestly like I'm really happy for you as someone that was there at the early days of Gawker Media, like five offices ago, and to see, you know, I remember, you know, when I left, you know, I left Deadspin for my own reasons and so on. But I remember talking to Nick. I don't really talk to Nick much anymore, but like the first year or year and a half after I left, I talked to Nick. Like I was, you know, I'd still hang out with DeLore and everybody, and I'd see Nick more and more. And he started to seem a little bit more bored. Like he started to seem around, and that was back where I would feel comfortable saying, Nick, I think you're bored. I think you're listening to the advertising people too much or more than you want to. And he kind of had that, there was a certain sense of you know, the site was becoming more, you know, it was becoming less his fun project he was messing around with people with and more of a business. And I think that was the initial transition for him. And I think what the sites have become has been great and so on, but I always waited for Nick to come back around to just kind of like knock shit around a little bit. And it is exciting for me to see not only that happening, but to see you, my friend and someone that I respect very much, in charge of that project. I have to tell you, it's incredibly exciting for me to see. So please do not fuck it up.
that was Nick's commandment to me as well. You know, when I interviewed for the job, the head of sales, Andrew Gorenstein, he asked me what Nick could do for me and to make my job easier. And I said, like, This headspace you're in, this mood you're in, whatever, I said this to Nick, just freeze it for the next year. So, like, let just long enough to let me bend the curve a little bit, you know? And Andrew, you know, he immune said, here. Because this is, there is an energy here. Everybody, the company is going back to its roots in a lot of ways. And we're talking about stories again. And how best to position ourselves to get stories. And that's like, you know, I tend to be a depressive and a pessimist about things, but I am excited in a way that I haven't been excited about really anything in journalism in a long time. This is sort of a thrilling opportunity to have these kinds of resources and this kind of editorial freedom. And it'll be great until I'm fired.
Of course, and that day we'll all have a drink and we'll discuss how why are all the sites now about cats? Listen, he's in a different headspace now. He's just it's a feline, you know, felines are the future or the past. Felines are eternal, really. Tommy, thank you for playing around with me, and thank you for making. I hope we will continue this holiday tradition next year. I think it's kind of a fun thing to get to chat with you, and I'm Letterman. You are my yearly Darlene Love to finish off the year.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you for doing this on top of a piano. I appreciate you doing this whole podcast in a red slinky dress on top of a piano. All right, well, stick around a little bit. We're going to say bye. We'll say goodbye on this podcast, and then we'll do trivia. I know you're nervous about trivia. Save it for the next podcast to tell me all your worries about trivia, because we're going to say goodbye on this one. But mostly, Tommy, thank you, and have a happy new year. And I really appreciate you doing this. And honestly, I'm really happy for you and proud of everything that's going on over there.
Thank you.
All right, thank you to Tommy Craggs. You can follow him on Twitter, as if he is ever on Twitter, at tcraggs, T-C-R-A-G-G-S 22, tcraggs 22. This is the Willis Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes if you're into that sort of thing. We will be back probably tomorrow or sometime before the new year with Tommy's awesome, totally going to kick ass trivia. But otherwise, if you don't hear that, have a wonderful New Year's. I'll talk to you all next year.